The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benrood from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
My name is Jeff Nugent. This story is called All His Hymns by Gabriel Szabo. Just a quick note, the hymns in this story is H-I-M-S. It's the same every year. He wakes up in a cold sweat, knowing what's going to happen, knowing he's powerless to stop it. In years past, he's tried to fight it, hiding himself away. But now, he just wants to get it over with. He lifts himself out of bed and slouches into the bathroom. He stares at the mirror, at the bags under his eyes, the lines on his face, at the receding hairline, and the yellowing teeth. All right, he says, let's do this. That's when his reflection reaches out from the mirror and grabs him, pulling him through to the other side. Well, it says, here we are again, you despicable, miserable little fuck. Here we are. Every year I hope this won't be necessary, and every year you disappoint me. It punches him, sending out a spray of blood and teeth, knocking him down to the ground. He doesn't try to get up. All right, boys, let's get to it. He knows they're all there, just beyond his vision, all his hymns. They come, one by one, to rain their blows and grievances down upon him. He knows that they are all richly deserved. The littlest ones, the hymns of his childhood, don't even know how to put their complaints into words. They are biting, scratching, screaming demons. The hymn of 12 is always vicious. At 12, his was an all-consuming greed. He can see it in the hymn's eyes, if he dares to look up. They are eyes that would swallow the world, set in a skull too stupid to know how small it really was. Why aren't you rich? Why aren't you famous? Why aren't you powerful? Why aren't you president? Why are you so boring? The hymn yells, stomping on his fingers, crushing each joint. God, I fucking hate you! The hymn of 16 is sullen, still entirely absorbed in his own world, though by then he had begun to learn his place in it. That doesn't stop the hymn from hating. You're just like all the rest of them, it says, as it takes a bat to his ankles. Just like all the rest. The hymn of 18 favors fire. At 18, he was at the height of his idealism and burned with righteousness born of ignorance. You were supposed to save the world, it says, covering him in oil, but you've only made it worse. It throws a match. Here in the mirror, mercy is a foreign concept. The hymns of his early 20s are haggard, tired, and bitter. Is this what I worked for? One asks. Is this why I stayed up all those nights studying when everyone else was having fun? For this? Why haven't you done more? Between them, they peel away most of his skin. Hymn of 25 is a romantic. We loved her. We loved her, and you let her leave. It cuts out his heart. The hymn of 30 was the last of them to dream. It says nothing. It only lifts up his mangled body and bends it in two, snapping the spine. After that, the hymns return to petty complaints. Why are you still living in this house? How come you never got that promotion? What happened to this project? Where's your book? Why? Why are you so little? Why aren't you more? Why aren't you everything we ever wanted to be? Each year, there are more of them. Each year, it takes longer. Soon, he doesn't think he'll be able to take any more, and the gauntlet will finally kill him. But not this year. This year, he makes it to the end, barely breathing. They stand around in a circle, the hymns. They stand, and they kick, and they stab, and they throw stones, but their hearts aren't in it anymore. They've each had their say. Finally, when he can't take it anymore, he says the only thing he can do to make this end, "Please, I'll make things right. Let me live, and I'll do better." His reflection holds up a hand, and the hymns stop. "I don't believe you. You always lie. Always. Tell me why I should give you another chance." "It's the same every year." "Because I've learned my lesson. Because I know what I need to do now. I'll stop drinking. I'll eat better. I'll go back to the gym. I'll start running. I'll stop just getting by and start doing again. I'll finish the book. Please, only let me live, and I'll do it all. You'll see." "All right, all right." His reflection takes a deep breath and lets it out with a hiss. "All right, boys, he's had enough." I believe him. The hymns cry out in disappointment, but his reflection ignores them. "I said enough." They listen. They take hold of him roughly and pass his broken body back through the mirror. As he lies panting on the floor, his reflection reaches back to pull him up by the hair. "Remember," it says, "1 year. That's all you have. 1 year. This time, don't waste it, or we'll be back." He nods. "Good." He pulls himself together. He picks himself up off the floor, and he cleans himself up. He puts on his clothes, and he heads downstairs. As he does, he tries to focus on the good in his life. He has a comfortable house, a job he enjoys, enough money to live well, a wife he loves more each time he sees her, children that make him proud. Why can't that be enough? Downstairs, his family is waiting for him. Later, they'll bring the cake with the candles and sing the song. He'll put on his best fake smile and try not to cry.
I'm Kurt Benrud. This is titled "Do Not Breathe" by Gunnar De Winter. Do not breathe. Nanites kicked into overdrive, trying to undo the damage of vacuum exposure. Being catapulted out of the airlock was a popular sentence for mutiny. No mess. Do not breathe. Dre twisted to face the ship that prepared to speed away. His face swelled. His long, thin fingers had become thick sausages. There wasn't much time. Do not breathe. Oblivion pounded heavily on his thoughts, an impatient guest that demanded access. He took the small grappling hook from his secret vest pocket. He was so excruciatingly slow. Do not breathe. Do not miss. Thwack. Here I come, Cap.
I'm Joanna LaForgia, and I'll be reading Yesterday Land by Renee Carter Hall. The door of the machine hissed, and the girl came out at a run, eager, fists clenched and legs pumping, as if the door had opened on ice cream and roller coasters and every last birthday wish. She skidded then to a stop, her sneakers sliding in ash and grit. So this was it, the future. Her heart roared in her ears as she stared at the choked sky, the dull earth, the craters and cracks that scarred the jagged horizon. Amid the charred trees and rubble, she saw only one recognizable object, and she walked toward it. A park bench, neat and trim in fresh green paint, where a white-haired man rested with his cane propped up beside him. He turned to her as she approached, and his eyes were wet. "I'm sorry," he said. "It's hardly what you were expecting, I'm sure. Hardly what I ever hoped for myself." There was nothing to say to that, so she shook her head and sat down next to him. "When I was your age, there were rockets, great shining things." He smiled at the memory. "For you, there should have been vast ships, green lands, cities in the clouds, planets lined up like jawbreakers in a candy store, all those beautiful horizons."
"Maybe there are," she said, "farther out."
He shook his head. "I've tried. I've looked all over, miles and ages." He pointed in each direction. "Over there, they fight for oil. Over there, they fight for water. Over there..." His hand waved a fluttering trail like a frail butterfly. "Over there, they just fight." Neither spoke for a long time. From somewhere came staccato gunfire, and from somewhere else the steady thump of marching troops. "Rockets," the old man sighed, as if it were the name of someone he'd loved long ago and lost, but would always love. The girl scuffed the toe of her sneaker in the gray-brown dust, drawing lines and smoothing them over. The future, her future, the one she'd worked so hard to see, the one she'd dreamed about so many times. Disappointment flared to anger, and then anger cooled to something quiet and steady, something that pulsed with her breath and her heart, a solid stillness she'd never known was there. "We could make it," she said, "both of us. There's plenty of room." She could hear the replies in the silence that followed. All those things she'd already heard so many times. All the reasons why not, why it wouldn't work, why it couldn't happen, why it shouldn't be. "Yes, but, well, actually, maybe if..." The old man stood and leaned on his cane. He looked toward the horizon, and then he looked back at her. "It will take a long time." She nodded, standing next to him now, watching black smoke rise from a distant explosion. "But maybe there'll be others." She thought of the people fighting out there. With nothing left to destroy, maybe some would want to build. Maybe the old man wasn't the only one who remembered. Maybe she wasn't the only one who still hoped. She held out her hand, and he took it. "Maybe," he said. The word was a whisper, and a promise, and a prayer. And together, they walked on.
This is Steve Lord reading The Treasure of Atlantis by Richard Wu. The morning after the storm, the boy heads to the beach in search of scraps. The sun casts a soft glow across the seashore, transforming murky beach sediment into a kaleidoscopic splattering of color. Reds and yellows, greens and blues, a rainbow of plastiglomerate fragments flashing in the light, like flecks of paint strewn across a canvas of sand. The boy watches the rippling colors dance beneath the water's roiling surface as wave after muddy wave unfolds over the shore. His eyes study the back-and-forth cadence, a rhythm accompanying the twirling flurry of loose plastiglomerate sediment. From behind the boy, a raspy voice grunts, "When I was your age, I collected shells at the seashore, not old junk scraps." The voice's timbre has a weathered quality, as if whittled by countless impacts from countless ocean waves. The boy turns to face his approaching grandfather, who carries a faded black box in his hands. The boy's eyes widen. A relic! The boy's grandfather gently opens the box. Inside is a rock that the boy has never seen before. The boy is transfixed by its swirling curvature, by the way its contours curl and wrap themselves together, like an ocean wave woven into a braid of stone. And the rock is hollow, with a gaping maw large enough to swallow up one of the boy's fists. "What is it?" asks the boy.
"Seashell," the grandfather answers. "Used to find them all over the seashore. At least until the beaches started looking like they'd been covered in candy."
The boy remembers hearing about candy from his grandfather before. He tries imagining the taste of candy trickling over his tongue, the bygone sensation of colors spun into flavor. Chocolates, peppermints, gumdrops, a spectrum featuring everything from the crimson swirls of luscious strawberry to the electric pricks of blue raspberry. Then the boy hears his grandfather continue.
"Back then, I'd go treasure hunting. Always wanted to find the lost city of Atlantis."
"What treasure did Atlantis have?" the boy wonders. "Candy?" The grandfather chuckles.
"Maybe. I wouldn't know, though. Never ended up finding the place."
The boy is the first to discover it later that morning. Something dredged up by the storm and half entombed in the plastiglomerate sediment, with a surface adorned in layers of rust and crumpled into the resemblance of a turbulent sea. The grandfather recognizes the object. They were once common, back before the plague, before the virus emptied out cities and left the abandoned husks of human civilization to the mercy of the encroaching oceans.
"A license plate,"
the grandfather mutters. He scans its faded surface. Most of it is too corroded to read, but he can make out one word,
"Florida."
"Florida?" repeats the boy.
"That's what this place was called years ago," responds the grandfather, who points at the rusted metal object. "The word written there."
"I just see bumps."
"Not bumps," the grandfather grunts. "Letters."
He grabs a jagged stone and proceeds to scrawl several looping shapes onto the beach's polychromatic surface. "What are you doing?" asks the boy.
"It's about time you learn to read and write. Might come in handy sometime."
What's the point of the letter C? It always sounds like K or S.
"A good question," responds the grandfather. "I don't really know. Just the way it was done back then."
A frown unfurls over the boy's face. This reading-writing stuff doesn't make much sense. The boy gazes off toward the horizon where the ocean lazily stretches out to meet the sky. The grandfather already knows what is coming next.
"Let's take a break,"
the boy exclaims, and he dashes off before his grandfather can respond. The grandfather sighs and smiles before following. The great dark mountain slumps out over the land, sprawled out like an enormous carcass too large for proper burial. From atop the mountain, the boy and his grandfather eye the shoreline below, watching as sunlight rolls off the undulating waves.
"Back then," says the grandfather, "entire stories were written with letters and words."
"Entire stories?" the boy repeats. "How many letters would that take?"
"Too many to count."
The grandfather stamps his foot on the dark mountainous earth.
"Like the hunks of dirt forming this mountain."
"Land," the boy murmurs softly at first, then louder, "land."
"Land?"
"Read it all by myself." The boy points to the ground where the four-letter word peeks out from the dirt. When he wipes the surface, additional letters emerge from the earth.
"Can you read the rest?" grins the grandfather.
Landfill,
the grandfather mutters. "We're standing on an old dump."
The boy tries to imagine countless garbage heaps stacked against the sky, trash piled upon trash, sculpted into an entire mountain, as numerous as the letters making up a story. The boy idly glances off into the distance when something catches his eye. It is another mountain, another story. When the boy and his grandfather reach the base of that mountain, they are greeted by the yawning mouth of a cave. Inside, sunlight spills down through gaps in the ceiling, glinting off pools of muddy water that drape the floor. A tomb-like silence fills the space, accented by a faintly musty odor hanging over the air. In the middle of the chamber, suspended atop rusty metal girders, is the dust-encrusted hull of an old winged machine. The machine's midsection is splayed open, like an animal prepped for dissection, with a bone-white sheen beckoning from beneath layers of accumulated grime. And running along the machine's side is one word. Begins the boy. "Atlantis." His eyes widen. "Atlantis! We found it!" The grandfather nods wistfully at the abandoned space shuttle.
"Yes," he says softly. "Yes, we have."
This is Sonia Usach-Kuhn, and I am reading Welcome by Liam Hogan. They saw our message, and so they came, across the city, perfectly synchronized with the end of the Queen's speech. Doorbells chimed, knockers knocked, and letterboxes flapped. Afterwards, it was clear that not every home had received the Christmas Day visitors. Only those with turkeys too big for the assembled families, tables with space for another guest or two, or three. They brought their own oddly shaped chairs. Once the screams had stopped, once the fainters had been revived, the visitors unfurled prehensile limbs and held out their invitations. It took a moment to sink in. And whether it was curiosity, the Queen's entreaty to help our less fortunate neighbors, a heartfelt plea for togetherness, or if it was merely relief that they were not anything like as fearsome as they had first appeared, extra placers were swiftly laid, and the people of London welcomed their guests from far away. None of the visitors spoke. They either couldn't or were not inclined to, but by a nod or a tilt of their thin triangular heads, at mostly appropriate moments, it was clear that they listened and understood. Some on departure left gifts, mere tokens, quirky little things that were quickly snapped up on eBay for small fortunes by scientists and wealthy collectors. But all of them turned back as they reached the bristly doormats, bowed deeply, and once again displayed their not-quite-paper invitations, tapping long antenna-like digits against the bold text. Hashtag, refugees welcome.
I'm Kurt Benrud. This is Wayfarer by Shannon Fay. The elf's name was Sekorin, and she had never met a human before. She asked if I would walk with her for a little while, and I agreed. Together we traveled away from the rocky coast and through the marshlands, bridging our two worlds with stories of our childhoods. We became lovers at the foot of a mountain, sharing smiles the next day as we climbed its peaks. We met other travelers along the way, some good, some bad, many of them much more attractive and interesting and daring than me. My heart would clench every time Sekorin met someone new. I was sure she would leave me once she realized that I wasn't anything special. She had only asked me to walk with her for a little while, after all. And yet the decades rolled by, and she seemed content by my side. We traveled the world. I had not known there were so many kinds of forests, of desert. Though my sense of wonder never dimmed, my other senses began to fail me. I moved slower. My joints ached. Sekorin herself never aged. Elves, she told me, lived for centuries. And that's when it hit me. A little while, for her, was a lifetime for a human. Human lives are so short. But that's all right. Mine has been happy and full. I will die of old age before Sekorin ever tires of me. And knowing that lets me rest easy in her arms. We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrud, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.